Blog Talk Radio.
Live to see it, friends. You're listening to Fast Forward Radio on the Blog Talk Radio Network. Fast Forward Radio is an audio production of The Speculist, and you'll find us online at speculist.com. That's S-P-E-C-U-L-I-S-T.com. Or go straight to the blog at blog.speculist.com. At The Speculist and on Fast Forward Radio, we are all about a convergence of emerging technologies and emerging possibilities, which are at the heart of this, the greatest period of transformation in human history. Our world is changing in ways that are hard to predict, sometimes even hard to imagine. And Fast Forward Radio is your guide to an astounding future that lies ahead and that will be here sooner than you think. My name is Phil Bauermaster, and with me in the virtual studio is my co-blogger, co-futurist, and co-host, Stephen Gordon. Hello, Stephen.
Hey, Phil. How are you?
Well, I am super fantastic. How are you, my friend?
Excellent. Excellent. Hope you're having a good week.
Well, I'm having a very busy week, you know, short 4-day week. You pay for that Monday off, don't you?
Yeah, you sure do.
You have to
do 5 days and 4 days anyway.
Exactly. Yeah. So I'm actually finishing up one project, starting another project, and then I've got like two others that didn't seem that big, but all of a sudden they're due, and it's good to have a job. That's what I keep reminding
yeah.
myself.
There are many who don't, so we have to keep positive, and it's good to have the headaches associated with a job rather than not have a job at all. That's for sure.
There you go. So, anything interesting happening in your neck of the woods?
I enjoyed the day off. Just spent it with the family, hung around the barbecue grill, that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's
and,
nice.
Just had a nice Labor Day off. But like you get back and you realize, hey, you still have all this stuff to do, and it doesn't matter that it's just 4 days, you still gotta do 5 days worth of work. So I'm with you on that. Yeah.
It's just the simple math of the four day work week. We gotta get to that 4-hour work week, I think.
Yeah.
Because if we can fit 40 hours into 4 hours, I think all will be well. You know what, Stephen? I just got thrown out of the chat room.
Oh well, let me check and see.
It said that someone else was logged in as me, so I don't know why it took that other person to be the real me and I as not me.
Well, that's what irritates me about this. Weird sort of identity theft, isn't it?
Obviously. He's the imposter, I think, and I'm pretty sure it's you, okay, because you're the one working two laptops here. So full disclosure to the listening audience of all the all the fun stuff we talk about before the show starts here. But, I was going to say that we've reached our statute of limitations on the movie Inception.
Yeah.
And so you had your chance, you know.
It was
a summer movie,
it like
and it's now September, time. Okay?
Yeah, and so pretty much I'm out of luck. Phil has got to cover the movie Inception.
Yeah, okay. Now, here's how it ends, okay? This is the weird part. No. I'm going to give you another grace period. I'm going to give you a couple more weeks so we can pick it up here. Because it's still showing somewhere in where you can see it, right? Or have you completely missed it?
I think there's a possibility I might be able to catch it up. And at a dollar theater now. So.
Exactly. Save some money. You get the extra big popcorn. Although, watch out. At the Dollar Theater, they charge more for the popcorn. So,
actually, probably we should wear a bulletproof vest, but it's cheap to get in, though. So.
Yeah, well, be careful. Hopefully, they're not saving too much money on the projector bulb. That's what I always hate. Right? When you go to the dollar movie and it's like they're trying to preserve energy, so they keep the projector bulb really dim, and you can't see what's happening on the screen.
It's like wearing sunglasses in the
theater. Exactly. It's like going to see it at a regular place and wearing sunglasses. But on the other hand, just speaking of interesting different models for movies, there is a new movie theater that opened up just a little north of our neighborhood at the beginning of the summer. And you know what they have? Free popcorn, and soft drinks.
That's pretty amazing because the markup on that stuff is like, you know, 500%. You know, I can't believe that someone's giving it away.
Well, here's what they've got. You know why? They've got a full bar, okay? So you can,
okay.
You can, I'm sure they're making up for it on the bar, but it's like they got, and they got really fancy snacks. They got sushi and stuff. So, I mean, you got all kinds of like wacky, things you can buy. But then there's just this really nice setup here, self-service, popcorn, and soft drinks. It's not big buckets, you know, but it's a nice size bag of popcorn, and, you know, you don't have to pay for it. And you can keep going back and get as much as you want. It actually kind of interferes with the movie, you know, because I must have made 6 trips back there to get more popcorn, but, no.
I got to, I guess it was a year or so ago, got to go to the Alamo Draft House down in Austin, and that theater is awesome, man. I mean, it's, the screen is huge. The sound system is like crystal clear, perfect, and you know you can order full meals and things. I mean, there's like a little table in front of you, and you put, you know, basically if you have something, if you want something to eat or drink, you write it on a little piece of paper and like put it there in front of you on this little slide thing, and like they'll come around, grab the pieces of paper, bring you your food, and you know that's. To me, it's a really cool way to see a movie. Sit there and had a full Mexican meal watching Tropical Thunder. So.
Oh, there you go. Good combo, actually. But
it worked out. It actually worked out.
Yeah. See, I think they're going with the same model, but it's not a sit down meal. It's just like you pick the stuff up and go in, and then they, as an afterthought, I think they added free popcorn and soft drinks, but. Yeah, it just seemed to fly in the face of what I knew about the movie business from way back. Because, you know, you've got the margins on the movie are very small. The margins on popcorn are great. You know,
yeah.
You can sell like 30 cents worth of popcorn for like $6. You know, the cup costs more than the popcorn does. And
the funny thing is, I mean, literally you could go home after the movie and pop popcorn for like 1/10 of the cost. You know, I mean, it's crazy markup. Yet people do it, you know, every single time they go to the movies, and
yep.
They don't even think about it. So it's the experience of sitting there, eating popcorn, watching a movie. It's we're trained to do it.
Well, certainly if Lucas makes any more Star Wars movies, I mean, I just can't even imagine going to see one of those in the cinema and not eating popcorn.
That's kind of part of the experience.
Yeah, you know, I mean, it just anything with like spaceships flying around and laser guns and stuff, you really want to be, you know, working the. It's all in the wrist, right? You're moving popcorn into your face the whole time. I think it's an important part of the experience. Well, anyway, enough about that. We've got a bunch of stuff we want to get into tonight. I called this program this evening the Acceleration Agenda, and so we're gonna spend some time this evening, Stephen, on some. Tried and true, familiar stuff. Actually, a bunch of topics that you were kind enough to tweet about. Just general fun, good developments in the future that back up what I'm calling the acceleration agenda. But I'm going to bookend that with kind of laying out what I consider the acceleration agenda to be. And I'm afraid that in order to really lay that out, we're going to have to get into two areas that we don't normally get into.
And what would those be?
Okay. Well, we're going to start off with religion. And then
right.
We're going to end with politics.
Okay, the things that you can never convince another person to about generally, you know.
The totally pointless things to talk about as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah.
And I don't know about you, but like, not religion, but like politics always comes up at like family get-togethers. And I'm not the one who brings it up. But it's suddenly, it's like you're having this discussion and you don't want to be having it, you know, because it's like, I'm talking to my parents who've had their views since like the late 30s, right? You know, and not to say that they're like stuck in their ways or anything like that, but I mean, I don't really think I'm going to make a lot of headway here, right? I always think, maybe just let it go when somebody says something.
Yeah, when they start down that road, you say, I love you, Dad, and just walk.
Exactly.
Away.
Mom, Dad, I love you guys. You are the greatest.
You guys
Thank
are great.
For raising
I love
you.
Y'all.
Yeah.
Just walk away.
This potato salad is awesome. And then you,
could it be any better?
Yeah. and then you just walk away. That's exactly right. But which is part of my philosophy is I never start conversations on these topics because it's pointless to talk to people about these things, except for when I want to. Okay. And so this is this is the exception time. And we have done it before. We've glanced around it. We, a few years ago, had our landmark survey at the Speculist, God and the Singularity. We're going to have to update that one of these days. But I really think that we want to spend a few moments talking about the attention-grabbing headline on the editorial page of yesterday's Wall Street Journal, or excuse me, last week's Wall Street Journal, Why God Did Not Create the Universe. There is a sound scientific
explanation. And that settles it for everybody, you know.
Well, okay, look, it's written in the Wall Street Journal. It's not the New York Times. Hello. Yeah.
somebody called.
It's not like it's the Denver Post, okay? Yeah.
All right, exactly. It's a publication we can trust.
Yeah, no, it's an editorial page that I generally agree with, okay, I have to say. But this is an op-ed written by none other than Stephen Hawking and his co-author Leonard, I never know how to pronounce this name. It starts with M-L, so I'm going to just say Mlodno. It's probably just Lodno in the M silent, or maybe it's Modno in the L silent. But anyway, that's the guy that writes with Stephen Hawking, I think, who helps transcribe his stuff and has been involved in these last couple of books. So this is actually, it's an op-ed, but it's what it really is a chapter from a book that he's got coming out, and I believe the book, ironically, is entitled The Grand Design.
which sounds like an intelligent design book, doesn't it?
Yeah. I'm going to read just a snippet here. He talks about the strong and the weak anthropic principles. In cosmology. This is a piece on cosmology by Stephen Hawking. And those who are familiar with Stephen Hawking's popular writings, he's, I guess, most famous for having written A Brief History of Time. And one of the ideas he outlines in A Brief History of Time is he talks about whether the laws of physics insist on this kind of hard start to the universe and whether that hard start to the universe implies the existence of God. And he talks about a future time when we're going to understand all of this better. And when that time comes, we will, you know, metaphorically, he uses the phrase, know the mind of God. And he takes a very even-handed kind of thing. It's like on the one hand, it seems like there's no real role for God to play. On the other hand, maybe one day we'll understand the mind of God. So he kind of ended it on a split the difference kind of a note. But that was, gosh, how long ago was that book? 20 years ago?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, Brief History of Time has been out forever, seems like.
Maybe 30. I don't know, 2025 anyway. Yeah.
Yeah.
So this book, I think you get a little older, you decide it's time to take positions on things. So he talks about the weak anthropic principle, which just sort of observes that there are these interesting coincidences, and the strong one, which seems to imply that somehow everything was put together for us. And of course, it's the strong anthropic principle that Tipler uses as his starting point for pretty much showing that physics demands the existence of God. But, you know, different people can come to different conclusions for sure, and Stephen Hawking is not an intellect to be trifled with. So here's what he writes. He says, "The emergence of the complex structures capable of supporting intelligent observers seems to be very fragile. The laws of nature form a system that is extremely fine-tuned. What can we make of these coincidences? Luck in the precise form and nature of fundamental physical law is a different kind of luck from the luck we find in environmental factors. It raises the natural question of why it is that way. Many people would like us to use these coincidences as evidence of the work of God. The idea that the universe was designed to accommodate mankind appears in theologies and mythologies dating from thousands of years ago. In Western culture, the Old Testament contains the idea of providential design, but the traditional Christian viewpoint was also greatly influenced by Aristotle, who believed in an intelligent natural world that functions according to some deliberate design." And that last part, starting with "in an intelligent world," well, that was a quote from Aristotle, obviously translated from the Greek. I didn't do the translating on the fly. Okay. "That is not the answer of modern science. As recent advances in cosmology suggest, the laws of gravity and quantum theory allow universes to appear spontaneously from nothing. Spontaneous creation is the reason there is something rather than nothing. Why the universe exists, why we exist. It is not necessary to invoke God to light the blue touch paper and set the universe going." Okay. So.
All right.
Case closed.
I find that completely a completely unsatisfactory answer. But.
Okay. All right. Now, you know, it's not like I said it. I was just reading it. So you're saying that Stephen Hawking has provided an unsatisfactory answer. So tell us
yes.
why.
I give him a D. if I could grade Stephen Hawking, but
yeah,
I find the very existence of anything to be a boundless miracle that is unexplainable by science. And, you know, I mean, you know, there are people that go back and say, well, before the Big Bang, or, you know, the Big Bang is part of a larger cosmology of the multiverse. You know, there's multiple universes out there. That's just, you know, the old saying is turtles all the way down. That's just adding another turtle at the bottom. There still is the larger question of why should anything exist at all? And, you know, the prime mover, God, is as good of an explanation, I believe, as any, and makes more sense to me than it can just happen all on its own spontaneously. That, I don't know. But, yes, there you go. So.
Well, there it is. See, to me, I agree with your critique by and large. I think that what he has technically done is answered the question, because technically here's what we've got. We've got laws of physics, laws of it's quantum gravity, I guess, from the recent gravity and quantum theory. That's the phrase he uses, so we'll use Hawking's phrase. Gravity and quantum theory allow that absolute vacuum, absolute nothing, can spontaneously split into equal amounts of matter and antimatter, energy and negative energy. Okay? Well, that's pretty cool. So it's like all it takes is nothing, and then you can have the whole universe. Well, no. Actually,
right.
It takes nothing plus the laws of gravity and quantum theory. Right?
Yeah.
Well, where'd they come from exactly? I mean,
we're talking basically that is information underlying the system, right?
Apparently,
there's
still
something interacting within
a
system of something, and so you know, we could be talking the mind of God there. You know,
to me the thing is, what Hawking has done, like a good physicist, and I'll praise him here. This is praise, and like a good geek, okay. Is he has answered the specific question. Do you need God to create the universe? Well, apparently not, if by technically you mean for the universe to come into existence. Now, the broader question of where did this multiverse with the laws of gravity, you know, the laws of quantum theory and gravity come from? Well, nobody asked me that, okay? The question was where did the universe come from, all right? And do you need God for that? No. So, in fact, I think your turtles all the way down analogy is exactly right. It seems you still end up with a context, and you still end up with, you say miracle, I'm going to say mystery. You still end up with a profound mystery of existence, not only how, but more importantly, why are we here? And we like to hope that there's a why, that there's a because to the why. It's comforting to think that there might be, although it's very profound in its own right to think that there's not. So here's actually where I'm going with all this. We're talking about the acceleration agenda, and I'm just setting the stage for some of the ideas we talk about at the Speculist and some of the ideas we talk about on Fast Forward Radio. I don't think you have to have a particular opinion on whether God exists. To be a speculist, okay, to be a true fast-forward radio devotee. I don't think you need to, you know, have decided that that's all nonsense and it's false, or that you need to, go to church every Sunday. I don't think that there's a particular opinion that is the right answer in terms of lining up with our agenda. But I think that it's important that it touches your imagination and that you recognize that this is, either way, a really huge thing, right? It's a really profound concept that you're dealing with. Because if you've got a multiverse, or whatever the context that contains the multiverse, that somehow has always existed, and that somehow spontaneously produces universes from nothing. I mean, even just saying those words out loud just sounds so outrageous. If that really exists, to contemplate that for a while will make you dizzy. And if it doesn't make you dizzy, then you're not a speculist, okay? That's my point. If you can't think about, if you believe in God, if you can't, trying to imagine the nature of God to make yourself dizzy, or trying to imagine the reality of a self-sufficient eternal universe, if that doesn't make you dizzy, then I think you're just not quite with us, okay? That's my point. So I'm going to call it the dizzy test, I guess. For
that's right.
for being a speculative.
Your mind is trying. What you're trying to do is juggle infinities and things like that. It's if you don't get a little bit of vertigo, contemplating these things from time to time, you're not with us.
Right. You need to think through again. That's my point. Yeah, if you're not getting dizzy, I just don't think you're thinking about it hard enough. Now, and the other part is this, and I think this is probably the most important part. The dizzy thing is just, I don't see how you can not be dizzy. But it seems to me if you're not dizzy, you're not paying attention. But the real one is this. You come to this point of pondering why we exist, this point of pondering how it is that the universe came to exist and why this particular universe exists with this galaxy and this planet and, this podcast going on, right? You start thinking about that, and then...
Important.
Yeah, here's the thought that occurs to me, okay? And this is where I think, really, you got to be on board with this one, okay?
All
existing
right.
Rocks. Okay?
Yeah.
It is way cool to exist. The more I think about it, it's like, boy, if it came down to a choice between nothing that never did anything or something that spontaneously emerged either through an act of creation or through the laws of physics, I'll take existing every day of the week. You know what I mean? Existing is a really exciting thing when you think about it.
Exactly.
I mean, we don't appreciate it, but, think about it for a minute.
We had a nutty college professor back in school who said, what God did was he took nothing and divided it by nothing and got infinity. And, a couple of us in the back of the class raised our hands, why couldn't he have just gotten nothing? he would just change the subject, Anyway,
I like it. Yeah, that's good stuff. So I think it's important to be excited at the prospect of existing. I actually believe that when we talk about the human imperative, when we talk about the law of accelerating change, what we've got is information.
In the chat room, Stella just gave a beautiful expression of the anthropic principle. If we didn't
that's
exist,
here.
We wouldn't notice. That's it.
That's a good point. See, we wouldn't even know if we didn't exist. That's why it's so exciting to exist, because we sort of know what we'd be missing out on if we weren't here to enjoy it all. But what you see is, as you see these greater and greater forms of complexity, you see greater and greater levels of connectedness between information, between intelligent minds. In terms of how we're able to communicate with each other, in terms of the capabilities that we take on, the things that we're able to do, it's like we're becoming, if this isn't too ethereal, if this isn't too esoteric, we're becoming more real as we go along. At one point we were, the universe, right? We were diffuse hydrogen, really hot, and then we became more specific. Galaxies, and then we became planets, and then ultimately you've got life on the planet, and it's just cells, and then it's more complicated cells, and then it's cells with nervous systems, and then it's organisms with brains, and then it's conscious organisms, and then it's conscious organisms who can communicate with each other in new ways, and then it's technology, and in a sense, it's like we're fulfilling the whole idea of the fact that we exist through our technology and through the acceleration thereof. What do you think?
Absolutely. It's it's hard to get your and talk about another one that can make you dizzy.
Yeah.
We're we have put it this way. Science from the beginning has basically been showing us how we're not the center of the universe in so
right.
many ways. You know, I mean, Earth revolves around the sun, not vice versa. You know, turns out our sun is a star, just like any other star. In fact, it's kind of a very, very common type of star. You know, and here we are in the middle of a galaxy, and it's not a particularly unusual kind of galaxy. Spiral galaxies are all over the universe, and you know, on and on and on. It turns out we're not the center of things. Well, in this new way of thinking about things, that perhaps we are now organized to an extent that you know matter has never been organized to this extent before. To be able to basically turn around and contemplate itself. So that's pretty intense, isn't it? It's pretty
kind of
deep.
Puts us on the, if not the center, kind of the leading edge of
that's
the
right.
universe, if not bleeding edge of the universe. So I'm enjoying the chat a lot. A lot of great stuff going on there. I like the Billy Preston quote: "Nothing from nothing leaves nothing." But apparently, you can get something from nothing. That's the deal that. That Stephen Hawking is offering us. I did want to point one other thing out about that. I don't know if that idea sounds shocking to people. That's really not a terribly new idea. I mean, it's new that it's been confirmed, or apparently is arguably confirmed through current quantum theory. But shoot, I read that idea in an essay by Isaac Asimov probably 30 years ago, and that might have been a 10, 20 year old essay at the time I read it. He was doing this ask me hard questions and I'll try to answer them kind of thing, and one of them was how did the universe start, and he said, well, maybe originally there was nothing, and if zero can turn into something like -1 + 1, maybe absolute nothing could have turned into, and you know, basically he outlined the same idea that we're getting here from Stephen Hawking. So it's not a completely new idea, and I think it actually has kind of it sort of resonates with some of the creation myths from different cultures around the world. So it's a really stark sounding idea, but not as shocking as maybe Hawking is hoping that it is. Although hopefully he'll sell some books. That seems to be.
I think that's the ultimate here. He knows he'll sell some books with that.
Yeah, he'll get some books out of the deal. So anyway, I just reiterate, I think you should get dizzy. I'm not insisting on a particular answer to the question, but I think it should make you dizzy, and I think you should really, really appreciate existence. I appreciate existence to the point that I'm very grateful that I feel tremendous thankfulness for the fact that I exist. And to me, gratitude makes more sense if it's directed to somebody. So that's where I kind of end up on the God page, I think. But I don't insist on that for anyone else. I'm not saying that's a reasoned out logical answer that others must adhere to. That's a personal choice on my part, I think, more than anything else. So you know, it's like I like existence so much that I want to have somebody to thank for it. And
that's right.
Yeah.
It's funny, Neil Gaiman, is it Gaiman or Gaiman?
I think it's Gaiman.
Yeah. He had a tweet the other day, it was like a week or so ago. He says, good night, universe. Keep on existing. I like that. That was
exactly. Yes, please do. Please keep on existing. Ken, nobody told
That's
you you're supposed
cool.
to smoke something before the show. No. You don't have to smoke anything. The concepts alone will get you there, buddy. That's the point. Okay, we're going to get you there with the concepts. Okay, so we've got a number of pieces that you've tweeted about lately that I'd like to talk about. Just little proof points that existing is better than not existing. That the world is heading in some very interesting directions. Do you have any in particular you'd like to start with?
No, we can just kind of go down the list. Personalized life extension conference. We've mentioned that a couple times in the show in the last couple of weeks. If you happen to exist on October the 9th and you find yourself where, Phil, where is this going to be?
That's going to be in San Francisco at the Marriott Hotel at the airport.
Exactly. So check that out if you happen to be existing in that region of the world at that time. So that'd be a pretty cool one.
Learn how to extend your existence a bit here, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Learn how to maybe take care of yourself well enough you can exist a little bit longer. Our friend Christine Peterson is she is the force behind this conference, and we wish her very well in that.
Yeah, and if anyone listening is going, get in touch with us and be our person on the scene, because Stephen and I would both very much like to be there. It's just not possible travel-wise for either of us to make that particular event. But if anyone is going to be there and would like to represent Fast Forward Radio or the Speculous there, we'd sure love to have you there and to hear about everything firsthand.
Absolutely.
Okay. Well,
have you had a chance to?
Oh,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just asking. Have you had a chance to try the Skype killer, Google's Gmail call system? I've not had a chance to try that.
So. Do you know we use that every week to call Malaysia? My wife calls her folks, and so they're able to talk with her and our daughter, and we do the video. Video phone thing. We haven't done it to an actual phone. I mean, we've tried it to an actual phone line, but we've actually been using just the video chat all this time. Have you tried the actual phone? You know what? We should do the show from that one week.
We ought to, and I was actually considering doing it tonight, and then I started having other issues, and I decided, well, let's not get fancy this evening. But, it's basically you can, from Gmail, you can now call any phone, like a cell phone or house phone or anything, from Gmail anywhere in the United States for free. And, that's the idea is, this might be a Skype killer if it works properly. Skype, of course, has some, I have found that Skype has some aggravating policies on their pay services that cooled me to Skype a little bit. Have you had some similar circumstances like that, Phil?
If you type the words Skype sucks into Google, you'll still find, if not the number one page, you'll find in the top five will be a Speculous article by me about.
I'm right with you
about that very issue.
Don't hold me to this, but it pretty much came down to. You pay for a service, and if you don't use it fast enough, it goes away. Well, that's fine. You keep that. I don't think I'll need Skype anymore. It was pretty much the attitude I had when that happened. So, if Google wants to come along and give it away and that kills Skype, you know what? I'm not going to shed a tear over that. So, so I thought that was a pretty cool deal.
Skype was great in its day. It was never particularly good for us. Last year when we were doing the World Transformed, we had a number of times when people were calling in via Skype, and it seemed that Skype compression plus Blog Talk Radio compression ended up with – I remember one night Alvis Bridges was on, and we lost about a third of what he said. It was just like just some basic audio incompatibility between Skype and Blog Talk Radio. But, it's a year later, so things could have changed dramatically technology-wise, plus this is Google. So I'm kind of interested to see if it would work.
Yeah.
Oh, Sally just tried Skype sucks on Bing, and Speculous was number two. All right, so we're still in the top two. Beautiful.
If I cared enough about Skype, I'd write another article with the same title just to bring us further up in the ranks.
See if we can get back up there. Yeah, that was our number one. That was one of our number one searches for quite some time. And it's funny, I wrote that thing, and I continued to use Skype for years afterwards. Because I still needed it sometimes, So.
Yeah. Well, sometimes things that suck are still better than having, nothing at all. It's sort of like, if you've had a bad day, it's still good to exist, right?
There you go. Exactly, Skype might suck, but being able to call somebody on your computer is a pretty handy thing, doggone it.
Yeah,
so,
exactly.
There you go. All right, so all right. I've got one.
Okay.
This is from The Economist. Riders on a swarm, mimicking the behavior of ants, bees, and birds, started as a poor man's version of artificial intelligence. It may, though, be the key to the real thing. So I don't know if you had a chance to read this article. I've just kind of skimmed it. but it appears that this kind of distributed modular version of intelligence that a beehive achieves or a colony of ants might end up being a good path towards getting to true AGI. The Economist is an interesting place to be reading about something like AGI because, it's not exactly like reading an article in H+. They're not talking singularity or any of that kind of thing. But basically, the idea of swarm cognition, I think is what they call it. And you remember there was a Michael Crichton novel a few years ago called Swarm, and it was kind of a gray goo, nanotech is bad scenario, so I didn't appreciate that part of it. But the key to the evolving intelligence of this nanotechnology, I'm sorry if I'm spoiling this book for anyone who hasn't read it, was that it was using this same set of algorithms that bees use when they swarm or that ants use when their colonies move out and take over in my case garage, right? But whatever it is they're working on doing, and by distributing the intelligence and increasing the number of units working, they were very quickly able to get up to human level intelligence, or what appeared to be human level intelligence. We never really knew what was going on inside the robots that they turned themselves into. All you know is you saw somebody who looked like somebody, and they were sort of behaving like them, but recognized that the intelligence was this distributed thing through the whole colony of robots making that thing up. Now, they don't go that far in this. In this article in The Economist, but I think it's very interesting that a very mainstream publication like The Economist is talking about something like this.
Oh yeah, and these ideas now that they don't geek out about it quite as much as we do, but a lot of these ideas are becoming mainstream, and that's just another example of that.
Yeah,
pretty cool.
The stuff of Michael Crichton science fiction, what was that, 7 years ago? Now, kind of a humdrum article in The Economist. I mean, not humdrum, but humdrum to the extent that everything in The Economist has kind of stayed and,
Yeah, calm down. Yeah,
exactly. Yeah, people don't get all excited reading The Economist, generally speaking. It's more like before you fall asleep on the airplane kind of reading. Okay, what else we got?
Okay, well, I don't know what if this is it certainly doesn't have anything to do with the larger aspects of the show, but I'm going to tell you, for some reason, I like this. Commodore USA announces the PC-64. It's an Atom-powered PC in a replica Commodore case. So pretty much, you could be the one guy at the office that looks like he's got a Commodore computer. So,
you got like a regular, just a powerful,
it's a regular PC,
modern day computer in a Commodore box.
Yeah,
that's awesome.
That just appeals to me. I think I'd like to have see if I can put a PC inside of an old Texas Instruments 99-4A. Remember that computer?
Absolutely.
I don't know, you even put one inside of an Atari box or something, Atari 2600 or something. But you just have to add a keyboard or something. I don't know why that appeals to me, but it'd just be funny. It would definitely be something you could laugh about, a conversation piece for sure.
For sure. Well, many years ago, I worked for a Macintosh magazine, and this was early enough along that I worked there at the time the Mac 2 was introduced. So the first
Mac...
Wow,
that's been a little while, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay. So, I'm... Well, I'm youthful looking. But
look, a day over halfway to 80.
It was, yeah, it was, thank you. The first Mac that wasn't shaped like a Mac. And it was still... kind of out there, and people were still primarily buying the Mac Plus. The Mac SE was picking up sales, but the Mac Plus was really the one that was really popular at this time. And so popular, in fact, that a guy bought a bunch of, I don't even know if you'll know what I'm talking about when I say this. Do you remember the Apple Lisa?
Yeah, I do. They were, That was their Edsel. That's basically the one computer that Apple ever made that was that just completely tanked. So this, how many leases did this guy get? That was like a $5,000 computer, man.
Sure, when they came out, but this is a few years later, and okay. he got them cheap, and he upgraded them so that they were essentially running Mac Plus operating system. So,
oh, okay. All right.
So you had a Mac Plus in a Lisa box, okay? And the Lisa, anyone listening to this, if you don't know what we're talking about, just Google Lisa and do the image. I mean, Apple Lisa and do the image. If ever there was like a computer from the 1950s picture of what a computer would look like one day, this was it, okay? Plus it had this big stonking like brick of a mouse next to it. It was the first computer that had a mouse. It was before the Macintosh. And really a lot of what went into the Macintosh was originally developed on the Lisa, and it was cool because you could run original Lisa operating system on it, or you could run the Mac Plus operating system on it. So it was kind of cool to toggle back and forth between the two. But anyway, what I was going to say was, if there's any of those old boxes lying around, that would be kind of fun. It would be to put like a, one of these netbook type laptops in a Lisa box, right? You know, just have all that color and connectivity and everything with that crazy
exactly.
Old 1950s retro-looking computer.
Yeah.
Oh, okay, well, how about this? Oh, go ahead.
I was just thinking that, there's also these little kits that you can buy that you can take an old 1930s typewriter and turn it into a keyboard for a computer. And, that would be a neat thing, too. I mean, to have one of these old typewriters on your desk, you know, typing on your computer screen with, you know, that's kind of neat too. And you see that every week on the show Warehouse 13. Is that it?
Yeah, I don't watch that show. That's cool though. I like the idea.
A little retro. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. I like the. You saw that kind of stuff on Battlestar Galactica all the time. There was always this mixture of like high tech and very, very low tech. Okay. Here's one that really appealed to me. New compound has superhero-like powers. This is important for those of us who intend to become sexy immortal billionaires with superpowers. It's a bird. It's a plane. It's a cliche. No, it's a new type of oxide compound. It sounds like boring stuff on the surface, but when researchers talk about the capabilities of this new oxide compound, the material sounds like it comes straight out of a comic book. Researchers at Cornell University found that when you physically stretch europium titanate nanometers, a tiny amount of the element nanometers of this stuff, it takes on superhero-like properties that could revolutionize electronics. When researchers stretched thin films of the stuff across another type of oxide, they became highly electrically polarized and exhibited a permanent magnetic field. These two qualities almost never appear in a single material in nature. When they do, they are pretty weak by comparison. The new compound that researchers developed is 1,000 times more powerful in terms of electrical polarity and permanent magnetism than anything that has ever been seen before. This new approach could prove a key step toward the development of next-generation memory storage and superb magnetic field sensors. Just two applications researchers have long dreamed about. And then there's a tagline about it. They didn't have to call it Justice League. But, this is really cool because here is the kind of breakthrough that doesn't even get noticed anymore because there's so much stuff going on. But this is really very exciting that a material is developed that demonstrates completely new and completely unexpected properties that have serious, very useful applications. And you see more and more of this kind of stuff as we have this kind of convergence of material science, computer science, the ability to fabricate things, to try things out, to model stuff. Is really producing some pretty interesting and exciting results. You can expect that this magnetic quality of this stuff is going to be showing up in devices we'll be carrying on our persons probably within the next decade or so.
And I think particularly storage, we need to basically play catch up with storage because Moore's law. It allowed us to increase the computer power exponentially every 18 months or so, but storage has not grown that fast. It's grown, but not at that speed. And so, you know, we need a big breakthrough in order just to catch up with, you know, storage capacity versus computation. So that's exciting.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. All right, what else?
All right. Okay, let's throw in something completely, you know, trivial.
Okay.
Nike files patent for auto-lacing shoes. Marty McFly does protest. I think that's awesome. You know, you see Back to the Future 2, you see these auto-lacing shoes. You know, you wanted them immediately. Well, you just have to wait a few years because, after all, that was the future. Now we're living there. So get ready to get your auto-lacing sneakers sometime soon, probably with a battery that has that new compound in it so that it lasts longer, right? So,
can I be a grumpy old man here just for a moment?
Okay.
You know what? I don't mind having to tie them. I just wish they would stay tied.
Well, right? You know.
How about technology?
Double knotting,
yeah. Well, that's what you double knot, and then they're kind of like, it's a little too short on one side, and you're walking along, and you got this big loop hanging off. And, you know, do something about that, okay? I'm good with time. I mean, that's a great, you know, time saver and everything, but.
We might have to get you some with Velcro or something, Phil. You know, whatever. We'll figure something out.
But, you know, back when that was cool. Back when that was cool, I had those. I would go back to those, but I think that's less cool now. I'm not sure. I'm no authority.
Running forth.
Yeah. I don't think you can do that. I used to have the kind that pump up, actually. It's like you lace them and then you pump them full air. Oh man.
Pretty awesome.
Those were the days. Okay, here's a question for you. Urine could be a source of renewable energy?
Yeah.
A research team at Harriet Watt University, UK, is investigating whether urine could be used to create energy via new low-cost fuel cells. Okay, now this is what I'm talking about right here. Okay, this is convergence right here. You want to talk about low-tech meets high-tech, okay? I mean, like, no-tech meets
high-tech. Basically, yeah, I don't have anything, but, you know, I'm... you know, how do I power this, how do I power my computer? I am dirt poor. I don't even have the clothes on my back. I am naked in the streets. How do I power this,
there you go.
Cell phone to call for help. Well, now.
Well, first drink some rainwater, then wait a few minutes, and yeah.
Then you're good to go.
Exactly.
Yeah,
go ahead. And
basically my comment on that is pretty much, you know, I don't see this being a big solution to our power problems in, like, you know, in the developed world. But let's say you're a soldier and in Afghanistan or someplace, and, you know, the various electronics that you're needing to use need power, and you know, why not have a fuel cell that's powered by urine in a situation like that? I think that's it's an excellent idea. So
one of the things I like about the picture they show of it is you've got so urine collected at source, then you've got this commercial urea solution that they use, and ammonia. Those are the three things that go into this fuel cell system. And what comes out of the fuel cell? Electricity and clean water. So
yeah.
this is kind of a nice little two birds with one stone kind of thing going on here, because not only are you creating power, you're disposing of waste in a very effective way, too.
Well, you know, that's here we're talking Dune technology here. This is a still
yeah.
suit from Dune, right?
Yeah, there you go,
Plus, it has the power to power those sound weapons, okay? So, anyway, there you are.
There you go, or at least work, you know, maybe your microphone in your still suit or something like that.
Okay, whatever.
I don't know how much power you can actually get from a quart of urine.
I don't know how geeky we can get, but that's getting pretty close, I feel like.
When you start talking the still suits that's pretty geeky. And thank you, because I like that. Okay, give us one more, Stephen, then I'm going to take us to politics and we'll wrap this up.
Okay, let's see. This is sort of funny. This tweeter asks, why do aliens always disembark via ramp? Do they have problems with stairs, or are the flying saucers just handicapped accessible? Anyway.
That is an excellent question.
Right. Again, that has nothing to do with anything, but it's just a funny thought. You know, we always have ramps coming out of these flying saucers and things. So, what's the deal? And my thought is, I'm sure the guy that was in the ET suit, who waddled up that ramp, appreciated the ramp over stairs, because I just think that he was probably going to kill himself on the stairs. So
there you go. Well, if I recall correctly, in the day the earth stood still, it was stairs. Am I wrong? Okay,
I'll
somebody listen.
I'll have
look
to Google that.
Get
somebody
picture.
In the chat room to, yeah.
Yeah, I think it was stairs. Okay, so politics now. We start with religion. We talked about the core religious ideas that you got to embrace in order to be a speculist. Not really, just some attitudes that I find useful. Now I want to talk about the political ideology that you must sign on with if you want to continue listening to this podcast. Okay. I am reading from a book entitled The Rational Optimist, about which we have spoken numerous times over the past couple of months, a book that will continue, I think, to inform what we do on this show and play a part in our upcoming broadcasts. I think, second to last chapter is called The Catalaxy, and there's a section from this book that I would like to read, if you will all indulge me, to read this. Onward and upward. I have presented the case for sunny optimism. I have argued that now the world is networked and ideas are having sex with each other more promiscuously than ever. The pace of innovation will redouble and economic evolution will raise the living standards of the 21st century to unimagined heights, helping even the poorest people of the world to afford to meet their desires as well as their needs. I have argued that although such optimism is distinctly unfashionable, history suggests it is actually a more realistic attitude than apocalyptic pessimism. It is the long ascent of the past that gives the lie to our despair, said H.G. Wells. These are great sins against conventional wisdom. Worse, they may even leave the impression of callous indifference to the fact that a billion people have not enough to eat, that a billion lack access to clean water, that a billion are illiterate. The opposite is true. It is precisely because there is still far more suffering and scarcity in the world than I or anybody else with a heart would wish that ambitious optimism is morally mandatory. Even after the best half century for poverty reduction, there are still hundreds of millions going blind for lack of vitamin A in their monotonous diet, or watching their children's bellies swell from protein deficiency, or awash with preventable dysentery caused by contaminated water, or coughing with avoidable pneumonia caused by the smoke of indoor fires, or wasting away from treatable AIDS, or shivering with unnecessary malaria. There are people living in hovels of dried mud, slums of corrugated iron, or towers of soulless concrete, including the Africans within the West, people who never get a chance to read a book or see a doctor. There are young boys who carry machine guns and young girls who sell their bodies. If my great-granddaughter reads this book in 2100, I want her to know that I am acutely aware of the inequality of the world I inhabit, a world where I can worry about my weight and a restaurant owner can moan about the iniquity of importing green beans by air from Kenya in winter, while in Darfur a child's shrunken face is covered in flies. In Somalia, a woman is stoned to death, and in Afghanistan, a lone American entrepreneur builds schools while his government drops bombs. It is precisely this inevitable misery that is the reason for pressing on urgently with economic progress, innovation, and change, the only known way of bringing the benefits of a rising living standard to many more people. It is precisely because there is so much poverty, hunger, and illness, the world must be very careful not to get in the way of the things that have bettered so many lives already. The tools of trade, technology, and trust, of specialization and exchange. It is precisely because there is still so much further to go that those who offer counsels of despair or calls to slow down in the face of looming environmental disaster may be not only factually, but morally wrong.
Absolutely.
So that, I think, you know, we don't get partisan on this show. I go to great lengths to keep from getting into specific political issues, but I think the more we explore these ideas and the more we understand what's really driving these transformations that we talk about on this program, I think you have to acknowledge that what's behind it is people being free to do what they need to do to improve their circumstances, and that has driven this tremendous transformation that humanity has experienced over the last few centuries. And if allowed to go on, it, I think, is going to take us someplace very, very positive, but we have to allow it to continue. And so, without getting partisan.
I love the way he put it. He said it was morally obligatory. And
yeah.
You know, it brings this thought to my mind. You know, it's important to have your eyes open about where we were 200 or 300 years ago versus where we are now. A lot of people look back on, you know, that time and see a grand golden age, and it just wasn't. It was a bad life. It was a hard life. And the reason, you know, we changed from that life to, you know, gradually to lives that we have now is because each little change that was made along the way was a change for the better, or we wouldn't have done it.
That's right.
And so, basically, you know, to the extent I'm going to get partisan tonight, basically, if a government policy or some sort of monetary policy or something like that slows down the rate of progress, I'm not sure we can stop it if we wanted to, but we could sure slow it down. Then, I hate to put it this way, but it will cost lives. It will certainly make the quality of lives worse, but it also, would perhaps keep us from saving people that are, you know, in need of saving in other parts of the world and stuff. So it's important that we keep the march onward and upward going. So.
I think, you know what, Stephen, as always, we're on exactly the same page. And, it really comes down to that. We talked, was it last week or the week before, or last week, about, you know, do solutions need to come bottom up? Do they need to come top down? I think when we had George Dvorsky on, we were talking kind of about, you know, the balance between things coming from on top or swelling up from below. And, you know, I came upon this formula that keeps bumping around in my head, which is that we live in this top-down world, but it seems that change really bubbles up from the bottom. All the transformations that we see occurring need to have that component of stuff happening from the bottom up.
I'm sorry.
In order to enable them to happen, go ahead.
Yeah, I was just thinking that, you know, one of the reasons bottom up works so well is, you know, nobody knows. The things that I would necessarily want for myself better than I do, you know, in a top-down, you know, command economy, you know, you got one guy up at the top, some dear leader, you know, telling, you know, here's what everybody needs. You know, we all get to wear gray jumpsuits and we all get to work between, you know, the hours of 7 a.m. and 7 p.m. And we all do, you push this button all day and, you know, That doesn't appeal to me, and few people would like to live in a world like that. So I guess what I'm trying to say, to the extent that there should be a mix, I'm going with 90-10. 90% bottom up, 10% at the top, just to every now and then to organize things that can't be done otherwise. You know, things like interstate highways are things that there's not a good profit motive for some corporation to pick up and do.
Yeah, I don't know what the numeric breakdown, but I agree. Maybe 80-20 because I love that breakdown so much. But definitely the top-down stuff is just there to keep the bottom up from turning into something weird or ugly. That's really its main thing, not to stop it or slow it down or to replace it, but just to put some important. Checks and balances in place around it. Well, Sally's given us the high sign that we're about to run out of time, and I actually had a big plan for, you know, how we can make all these things happen, but I guess we'll have to save that for another week. Stephen, what's our music?
Fill the Lens by Maniac.
Fill the Lens by Maniac. All right, well, thanks for putting that together. Thanks for all your contributions to the program, Stephen. I appreciate you giving us our topics tonight. Hey, thanks to everyone, Sally, and everyone in the chat room for being part of the program. If you're listening live or if you're listening via recording, thanks for being part of Fast Forward Radio. We'll be back again at the regular time next week. And until then, live to see it.
Thank you. Forever.